I'm Christopher Lydon, racing for the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's Rendezvous with Death. So many conversations in this season touch on JFK, and we'll have several of them. This first one begins on an obvious question that we're not supposed to ask. It's not so much, who killed JFK? It's more, why don't we know? I'm putting it, simple as that, to the independent historian James Douglas in Birmingham, Alabama, who says the answer is unspeakable. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. James Douglas, born in Canada, is a longtime peace activist in the Catholic worker movement, best known for its urban soup kitchens and its shelters for the down and out. But for a dozen years, Jim Douglas absorbed himself also in studying the life of John F. Kennedy and the meaning of his death. His book, first published 5 years ago, is titled JFK and the Unspeakable. Jim Douglas, on a Skype phone from Birmingham to Boston, welcome to Open Source. I've read rafts of Kennedy books, but I was late getting to yours at a friend's urging. By now, I've read it over and over. I may never get it out of my system. For a great many people who can't accept the official version of Lee Harvey Oswald as the lone assassin, you've opened up at least a plausible alternative. You lay out a trove of evidence and a very different shape of the narrative. Start with this maddening question mark. Why, 50 years later, has there never been a clear consensus on the evidence in a crime that broke so many hearts and that mocks the hope of politics even today?
Well, the question of knowing who killed John Kennedy is, I think, almost a question that leads us astray, because then it begins to focus on a question of shooters. And the question of what killed him and why he was killed focuses instead on the evidence that we have, which is that the shooters are almost irrelevant, but the system is very relevant. The government is very relevant. The nature of the context, the military-industrial complex, is very relevant. And the relation, above all, of JFK to his government is at the heart of it. So when we go that direction, we'll learn not so much who killed John F. Kennedy as what killed him. And of course, we'll find out who were the people involved. That's not very hard to do, really. But the nature of the question will take us so far into what Thomas Merton called the unspeakable that we'll almost feel like we're lost in darkness even as we're seeing the light.
There are two big dimensions here of your revisionist story. First is John F. Kennedy, the man. Behind that dazzling smile and the sort of Camelot camouflage, in your story, he's a badly burned warrior waging peace campaigns, both open and secret, in the last year of his life. He's trying to get out of Vietnam, to end the Cold War, to reconcile with Fidel Castro, among other things. But then there's this second big argument that the seriousness and the success of Kennedy's peace politics was precisely what got him killed. And there's no way to state your point that isn't shocking and really outrageous. It boils down to the idea that the CIA and parts of the Pentagon, the national security state, as we call it now, conspired to kill the president to save their power and their livelihoods and their worldview. Is that a fair summary?
It is a fair summary. And that's what Merton was suggesting by the unspeakable. I think that if we understand well our history from the dropping of the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we can begin to see the perspective in which JFK was killed, because World War II and the national security state that it created provided the apparatus that killed JFK, and specifically the National Security Act and the CIA's development of the doctrine of plausible deniability, which meant that the government, in its agencies, and CIA in particular, could go to the extent of sabotage and lying and propaganda and assassinations in a way that would, of course, be against international law. You're not allowed to do any of those things, but which could be done in a way that was not traceable back to officials in the United States government. That's the doctrine of plausible deniability. It's in a government directive. And by allowing that process to go forward, in which U.S. government officials in the CIA in particular killed foreign leaders and overthrew their governments, that set up the apparatus of doing exactly the same thing domestically. And plausible deniability and the need to know doctrine, another thing that manages to cut the connection between responsibility and action, those doctrines made it possible for the government to execute a president who was seeking peace.
Let's hold for a moment the story of politics, policy, doctrine, the grand scheme. I'd love you to focus on your picture of John F. Kennedy himself. He was a child of the war in the Pacific, of Cold War politics himself, but you describe in this book a grand turning of a Cold Warrior against war, especially in his last year in life, last year in office. Give us your John F. Kennedy.
Well, JFK was a man who was, in a sense, dying all his life from a child who had all kinds of problems in his health, who was bedridden for a good part of his childhood, to a man who had Addison's disease, a man who had very serious back problems virtually his entire life, and then had that kind of disability aggravated terribly by his Pacific experience when he was in his PT boat and it was cut in two by a Japanese destroyer, and he had to swim for many, many hours, saving the lives of his crew members. His health put him at the edge of death all of his life. And so he had a raven on his shoulder. And he regarded that as a way of living for the fullest kind of experience possible. And in a sense, that created the power and the weaknesses of his character. He lived for each day, and he wanted to create peace each day as he became more and more aware in his presidency of the critical reasons for doing so. In his time as a senator in the United States Senate, he took positions on issues that other people did not. He supported third world movements, especially in Algeria, in Vietnam, for independence that were definitely off limits to other senators. They would not go that direction. And he became a person who was able to live on the edge because he was willing to lose it all. In other words, he was expecting to die soon from his many experiences in that direction. And as a president, he could accept the risk of death and go all out for what he believed in.
He was a contradictory personality. I mean, let's remember, he was thought to be soft on Joe McCarthy's anti-communism in the 50s. He was the child of a kind of isolationist during World War II, his father, Joe Kennedy. In his 60 campaign, he had a very kind of anti-Soviet emphasis on what he called the missile gap that proved to be an illusion. But, I mean, what are you making of the man himself?
He was a person who almost was detached from politics to a certain degree, in the sense that he didn't really give a hoot about doing things that didn't actually change the world. He became a politician out of the consciousness of his father and his family that it was a possibility for actually doing something. But as a member of the House and even as a senator, he was short of the power where he could actually do that. And as a result, even though he took positions that were important, he also was a kind of lackadaisical member of Congress and the Senate compared to other people who were heavily into it all the time. But when he began running for the presidency, he then emerged in a way that surprised a lot of people, and especially surprised people as he got closer and closer to it, and as he became president himself. And it's a characteristic of Kennedy. He had a detachment and yet a seriousness when he had the opportunity to actually change things that made his detachment a huge asset. Because when you spoke to him, he focused entirely upon you. And at the same time, it was almost like he was up in the ceiling looking down at it all. He didn't become so involved in anything he was doing that he made serious mistakes because of an attachment to it. And that's a highly spiritual characteristic, to be able to have a detachment of that kind, especially as president of the United States.
The personal piece of this story rings true to me about a sort of political adventurer at one level who had had an intimate experience with war and death in the Pacific. I mean, these stories of his towing mates from the PT-109 hours and hours through the middle of the night at great peril, if not from sharks, from drowning from the Japanese, and also the fact that he'd had the last rites of the Catholic Church 5 or 6 times. I mean, he'd been at that edge of disaster really all his life and was still a buoyant, thoughtful, active, critical-minded, inquiring sort of guy with this serial rendezvous with doom. Stick with that pattern of his life and maybe of his death. We need to know it again, especially because so much of it was overwhelmed by sort of a false picture of vigor, athleticism, recklessness, sexual adventure, all these other stories that now seem distractions.
They are distractions because in World War II, he really developed a horror of war and a huge distrust of military authority. He saw his crewmates die. He was horrified by the way in which high-ranking people treated the members of the service with disdain, manipulated them, and used their lives. So when he became commander-in-chief, he had a very, very critical view of the military. People didn't realize a lot of this when he became president, but I'll say that there was one category of people who did understand the whole thing. And that is intelligence officials. They've been studying John Kennedy for a long time. They knew him in a way that other people didn't because they had studied him. They study all of us. And they especially study people who are powerful. And Kennedy was moving up the ladder of power. And they, of course, had studied other members of his family, particularly his father. His father was a very powerful person as ambassador to England and as a person within President Roosevelt's administration. So the CIA and the FBI had a profile of Kennedy, and they knew how they thought they could control him, as they think they can control any president. He fooled them. He didn't go their way, and that began happening as soon as he became president. It was even before the Bay of Pigs, in the issue of Laos, which was the biggest issue in Southeast Asia, not Vietnam, when he became president, he immediately began moving toward a coalition government with the communists. And the CIA just as immediately began trying to disrupt his effort to stop any warfare in Laos by supporting a coalition government. Well, they didn't want a coalition government. They wanted a victory. They wanted to beat the communists, not make peace with them. So from the very beginning, even before he became president, when he was being briefed by his predecessor, President Eisenhower, he was already showing by his questions regarding Laos, Vietnam, Cuba, that he had a different perspective on things. And when he came into office and when the CIA presented him with this plan to invade Cuba via the Cuban exiles, whom they had trained for a covert invasion in which the Kennedy insisted that there be no U.S. service personnel involved in any direct fashion, they thought they could manipulate him into a situation where he would have to call in the Marines, call in the Air Force, call in a massive invasion of troops. They tricked him. They gave him false information. They said that the Cubans were about to overthrow Fidel Castro. They said that the CIA-trained exiles could become guerrillas if, when they came into the beachhead at the Bay of Pigs, they were hit by the counterforce of Fidel Castro's troops. They said, well, they can just go guerrilla. Well, there were no mountains around there. There wasn't any area where they could go guerrilla. So Kennedy was given false information. He reacted to it by refusing to do what was necessary for a victory. And he had drawn a line in the sand saying, I'm not going to go there. It has to be the exiles alone who either achieve a victory through support of the Cuban people or nothing. And when the CIA set him up, as was obvious to him in retrospect, he said, looking back on it all, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. And he then fired the CIA director, the most powerful person in the Cold War, Allen Dulles, and he fired his chief aides for their role in the whole operation, which was a covert operation against John F. Kennedy.
In 1962, of course, in October, the missile crisis was an even graver, much graver, more nearly catastrophic nuclear showdown with the Russians. And again, Kennedy confronted the military over their eagerness to take out the Russian bases in Cuba. He also fought back against the wilder fringe of the military that thought of a preemptive nuclear attack on Russia. And then we enter the critical sort of last year of Kennedy's life, 13 months, and the turning of a Cold War. Give us your version of Kennedy's turning in his last year.
I think you identified the right beginning following the Bay of Pigs, although there was also the steel crisis. We might want to refer to that a little bit later, because he certainly turned against the leaders in the military-industrial complex in the steel crisis. But in the Bay of Pigs, and then especially in the Cuban Missile Crisis, he is confronting really the center of the national security state, the CIA and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he's losing control of the situation in the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's at a point toward the Friday and the Saturday of the final week of that crisis where the military is taking steps. For example, the head of the Air Force, General Curtis LeMay, is sending U.S. planes carrying nuclear weapons right alongside and into Soviet airspace to provoke the other side to begin to move toward a nuclear war, which would then justify a retaliation, which was actually a first strike by the U.S. forces. They're even firing missiles into the Pacific, which are supposed to be test missiles, but the Russians can't tell the difference between a test missile and one that is actually aimed at them. They're doing all kinds of things. The military are doing all kinds of things to provoke the other side into making a move and then moving faster than Kennedy even knows what's happening. So Kennedy sent his brother, Robert, to the Soviet ambassador in Washington and said, basically, I need your help, to Khrushchev via Ambassador Dobrynin. He said, and this is recorded by Dobrynin and by Khrushchev, that he felt he was losing control. This is said via Robert Kennedy, his brother, the attorney general, and that he basically needed a very quick decision by Khrushchev to withdraw the Soviet missiles from Cuba. And in exchange, Kennedy would pledge never to invade Cuba and secretly would withdraw U.S. missiles from Turkey, which would be tit for tat with the Soviet missiles from Cuba. Khrushchev, when he received that message, turned to his foreign minister and said, we have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. And Khrushchev himself was astounded by what he'd said. And he was going to help his enemy get out of that situation by an act of trust, trusting that he would withdraw his missiles, as he was saying that he would do as soon as he could do it. He couldn't do it immediately because of pledges, NATO pledges to Turkey. So Khrushchev then went on the air very quickly in the radio and said he would withdraw his missiles. But as soon as he took that step, he became closer to John F. Kennedy, and Kennedy became closer to him than either was to his own military establishment, both of whose establishments were pushing hard, but in particular, the U.S. military were pushing Kennedy, and they were in a state of astonishment and feeling betrayed by his not having invaded Cuba, by his not having taken out those missiles, which would have initiated a nuclear war because the missiles were already armed with nuclear weapons. And that's the story for the last 13 months of his life. He and Khrushchev, in spite of continuing conflicts, working toward the end of the Cold War. And then those steps follow one after the other. The most significant is his magnificent American University address, which anybody can read today. It's a speech that is the most significant one in his entire life.
James Douglas, it reminds me very much of Jeff Sachs's version of JFK in his last year. Jeff Sachs, the Columbia University economist, who speaks also of JFK in his last year as a kind of raging peacenik inside the publicly sort of reckless Prince of Camelot. I mean, he's a man on fire for peace. He's been radicalized by the Bay of Pigs, by the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's in dialogue with Khrushchev behind the scenes. He's reaching out to Castro too. What is so different about your view?
Well, that picture is half the picture, but half the picture isn't enough. Kennedy's peacemaking is the reason why he's assassinated. Kennedy's peacemaking is the reason for his intense conflicts with his military and CIA advisors. Kennedy's peacemaking is the reason why they're cursing him, which we have on record, when he leaves the office after telling them that he will not invade Cuba. That's in his meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the midst of the missile crisis. Kennedy's peacemaking is the reason for General Curtis LeMay being furious with the conclusion of the missile crisis, which is the negotiated settlement with Khrushchev. And LeMay walking out of the president's office in a rage after Kennedy had given him a mark of respect, you know, a special calendar showing the days of the crisis and thanking his military advisors who had actually been working against him in the crisis. But LeMay comes out and he's furious. He said, we should go in there right now and attack them.
James Douglas, I wish you'd say more about that peace speech at American University in June 1963, in which he asked American people to introspect on war, on our own society, on the imperfections of it, also to think again about what is Russia, think about being able to see the virtues in one's enemy. As I read it now, and I've read it several times in the last year, it seems to be addressed to his own military. It's addressed to people who don't believe that peace is possible. It's not addressed really to the public, or much less to the communists. It's addressed to skeptics in his own security establishment. Is that plausible?
I don't think it's addressed only to the military. I think he's addressing it to everybody in sight, including his opponent, Nikita Khrushchev. And his beginning by talking about the suffering and the death in the Soviet Union is an obvious effort to reach out toward the so-called enemy and an effort to build a bridge with them. And that wouldn't be taken very well by the military. He, in writing that speech and preparing it with Theodore Sorensen, and especially with the writer and editor of the Saturday Review, Norman Cousins, who had a great deal of influence on him, he kept it a secret, actually, from the military in his preparations. And he's reaching out to his countrymen, his fellow citizens, in a way that, as you say, asks them and asks all of us, even today, to examine ourselves and see if it isn't we who are a chief obstruction to peace, and not just the Russians. Now, that was heretical in those days. Everything was the Russians' fault. Every time you tried to make any move for peace, the question was, what about the Russians? Kennedy is saying in the heart of the American University address, what about us? If we're going to have peace in the world, it's not just a matter of the Russians, it's us. We have to change. We have to turn toward peace. And then he takes specific initiatives. He says, I'm going to stop nuclear atmospheric testing right now as an act of trust toward the Soviet Union. I want a nuclear test ban treaty. And the head of the UK government and I, Mr. McMillan, and I want this as soon as possible. And lo and behold, 6 weeks later, they have that treaty. 6 weeks later, can you imagine a treaty between the two leaders in the opposite sides of the Cold War negotiating a critical treaty in 6 weeks? And that was done because Kennedy negotiated it himself from his office directly to Moscow. And there is another indication of what's going on. That treaty was negotiated not in the U.S. Capitol. It couldn't have been in the U.S. Capitol. It had to be. He had to go to Moscow to be able to trust the process, because everybody in his national security state at any critical position was trying to undermine him at that point. He was moving far too fast for any of them.
There were other moments, there were other speeches in JFK's last year that you read now with an air, they have an air of epiphany and prophecy, the sound of a man in struggle and seeking and maybe seeing the light, as in Ireland, for example, where he said, I'm quoting him, the supreme reality of our time is our indivisibility as children of God and our common vulnerability on this planet. Or those marvelous lines in the peace speech at American University. He said, in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal.
And we are all mortal. There's the heart of it. Kennedy knew his mortality profoundly. He looked at his children. He sensed, he knew the mortality of children everywhere. He knew they were dying from atmospheric testing. That's why he was so committed to the test ban treaty that he actually got through miraculously, he thought, through the U.S. Senate for approval at the height of the Cold War, a huge victory for a movement toward clean air, cleaner air than was then possible. He saved the lives of literally millions of people by that test ban treaty. So, yes, we are all mortal. And he saw that mortality, and he made a commitment to peace and to justice precisely for that reason.
You know, in all of those phrases, we hear the genius of Ted Sorensen, as well as perhaps the mind of John F. Kennedy. Can you figure out where one begins and the other ends? And what is your role for Ted Sorensen in this whole thinking about JFK's death?
Well, where Ted Sorensen begins and ends is in the mind and heart of John F. Kennedy. Ted Sorensen was a very, very eloquent and helpful and supportive counselor, as he says in his autobiography, to John F. Kennedy. Anybody who's trying to say Sorensen put words in the mouth of JFK doesn't know Kennedy and doesn't know Sorensen. Sorensen is eloquent and he gives Kennedy phrases, but he knows what Kennedy wants him to say, and that's the key. Sorensen was a conscientious objector. Can you imagine a president of the United States having as his chief counselor a man who is identifiably a conscientious objector? When people were pointing this out to Kennedy as he became president, they said, you can't keep on Sorensen. He's a CO. And Kennedy said, so what? He's been working for me for years and years. He's a tremendous help to me. I'm not going to fire him because he was a conscientious objector. That's good.
Did you ever get to talk to Ted Sorensen about Kennedy, and especially about your theory that Kennedy was killed by his own security establishment?
Yes, I did talk with Ted Sorensen. I feel that to say what Ted Sorensen said to me is to speak beyond what I really want to. And the reason for that is that he said things to me in confidence that he didn't wish to say publicly, and I won't say them publicly. But he spoke to me very supportively, and he initiated the communication with me.
Are you writing his thoughts, do you think? And are you writing his version of the assassination?
I'm certainly not. I'm writing what I think is the truth of the assassination.
Was he interested in the general argument that Kennedy's military and intelligence people had killed him?
He was definitely interested in all of that, profoundly interested. I'm trying to be true to what Ted Sorensen said publicly, and at the same time not be speaking about things that he said to me privately and didn't wish to discuss publicly.
And why not?
He is a person who wanted to speak about John F. Kennedy's legacy to the world. He didn't want to talk about specific possibilities regarding his death. So I can't say anything more than that.
We've got to talk about the endless contradictions, even in Kennedy's public record. I mean, he had run against Nixon on a non-existent missile gap. He opened his administration with a big nuclear buildup. You picture him plausibly, I think, as a peacenik at the end of his life. And yet he and Bobby Kennedy never called off that mafia assassination effort against Castro. John F. Kennedy had told Walter Cronkite in the late summer of 63, that there was no getting out of Vietnam. JFK's people were in on the assassination of Vietnam's President Diem 3 weeks before Kennedy himself was killed. Diem, who had gestured at settling the Vietnamese war with Hanoi. Kennedy also loved taunting Khrushchev. I mean, let them come to Berlin. He enjoyed it as much as Ronald Reagan did, baiting Gorbachev when he said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall.
Kennedy was a cold warrior. Kennedy came into office as a cold warrior, and he was elected as a cold warrior. He campaigned as a cold warrior. The process of his turning toward peace is not without contradictions, and a number of his moves are done secretly in the sense that he's incapable of doing them publicly. He can't negotiate with Fidel Castro publicly, so he's actually doing it all in a very circumscribed way. And he's saying things on another issue, Vietnam, which contradict the moves that he's taking privately. A president of the United States doesn't take a 180-degree turn in policy and get anywhere. He has to do it step by step. So when Kennedy is talking one way on Vietnam publicly, he's actually in the process of just about to sign National Security Memorandum 263, which will achieve a withdrawal from Vietnam by 1965 and the first 1,000 troops out during 1963. So he's doing all of that step by step, And he's not always publicly, in fact, very often he isn't publicly acknowledging what he's doing. But the overall policy directions are public. The American University address is the defining moment of that.
You know, in a record of so much contradiction, James Douglas, how do you know you've got the right thread? I mean, he was always talking at several different levels.
You know it from evidence. The man got killed. And the man was killed by his own national security state. Lee Harvey Oswald was an operative for the Central Intelligence Agency. He was a radar operator for monitoring CIA U-2 spy planes when he was in the Marines. He was a fake defector to the Soviet Union. And he was a patsy, a scapegoat in the assassination. There's all kinds of evidence regarding the assassination itself that implicates heavily the CIA and Kennedy's own national security state. So the assassination evidence corresponds to Kennedy's turn toward peace. The motivation for his being killed is his turn toward peace. That's the most significant part of the story, because that's what any president who follows him knowingly has to deal with. This is not a secret story. It's a story that's the unspeakable. Nobody wants to talk about it. And all the evidence is out there. So what I've written is publicly available evidence. All I'm doing is putting together what's out there in terms of literally hundreds of thousands of documents, which from the JFK Records Act of 1992 have been declassified. And you can read them in the 100 pages of endnotes in the book. Document after document shows, on the one hand, Kennedy turning toward peace, and on the other hand, his national security state conspiring to kill him. So it's all documented. It's not my trying to say, oh, this is something that nobody can find. It's all out there. The unspeakable is the failure of people who are far better historians than I to reveal it before this kind of neophyte, a person who's learning his process of being a historian as a Catholic worker. The failure of other people to do it before me is a very big question.
That is part one of my conversation with James Douglas. In part two, we speak about the resonance between James Douglas's book and Oliver Stone's movie, JFK, and about what Robert Kennedy knew and didn't know about his brother's death. Also, what James Douglas learned from the visionary monk and author Thomas Merton, who long ago, in the early 1960s, foresaw a miracle that could turn JFK toward peace and could mark him in turn for assassination. I asked Jim Douglas, before we're done, just what sort of evidence it would take, what sort of court, to nail a conviction for his charge. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with James Douglas, whose book is JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. We'll have several more JFK reconsiderations in this 50th anniversary autumn after his death. In all of them, I invite listeners like you to share your light on a dark and daunting subject at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Project.